record, so you're gonna get prompted that we're recording. And then there we go, we're set. And then I was gonna do a quick intro and then we're off to the races. Welcome back to the Evidence-Based Dermatology Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Putman, and this is episode 110, a moderated discussion about subgroup analyses from the Pexavast trial. I think I'm calling it that, but we'll see where it actually goes. To have this discussion, I'm very excited to be introducing Matt Stunick, who will be the moderator, and Dr. Michael Walsh, who will be the person that I want to discuss this with. So with that, I'm going to kick it over to Matt to kind of introduce everybody and the topics and go from there. All right, Matt, take it away.
Yeah, thanks for having me back, Mike. I guess I'll call you Dr. Putman instead. We've got two Michaels this time. So I'm Dr. Matt Stunick. I'm a rheumatologist and the VCRC vasculitis fellow and a PhD candidate here at McMaster University, studying exclusively trials and epidemiology and vasculitis. And I'm heavily conflicted, as I have published and am continuing to publish with both of you, and Dr. Walsh is also my PhD supervisor. So there's no saving me. This topic came up, has been a subject of interest since the publication of the Pexavast trial, really, where the best answers we have yet as to what we can do with glucocorticoids and plasma exchange in severe ANCA-associated vasculitis. The data for that came up indicating that it looks safe for to use lower dose glucocorticoids in terms of death and end-stage kidney disease, and subsequently to be published probably for relapse and ANCA vasculitis, and also showed that plasma exchange does not appear to make much of a difference except in people with severe kidney disease. And lots of people have interpreted this trial in lots of ways, and guidelines have come out, but they are still discussed within the vasculitis community. And most recently, at ACR 2023, there's a publication by the French Vasculitis Study Group who tried to recreate many of the Pexavast conditions using a retrospective cohort within their data, which showed results that from the perspective of the reduced versus regular dose glucocorticoid taper conflicted with the Pexavast results and actually suggested there was trends to warrant harm. However, there was a lot of details within that data to be said. So when that came up, I had been in touch with both of you, and there were many interesting reactions on Twitter and other places of people with various reactions. And there continues to be people bringing up both studies. And that sort of forged this conversation, bringing the three of us together to talk about each person's interest in both the outcomes, the interventions, and the methodology, and how we can most effectively interpret this data for a group of very sick people where these decisions are very high impact for their survival. So I'll hand over to you, Mike.
Thanks, Mike. Thanks, Matt. Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. And I'll, you know, make my first disclaimer is that I am a nephrologist, not a rheumatologist. So I apologize. And I will also say, Matt's careful how you spin this. Your PhD could be elusive if it was the wrong way. So, Mike, I don't know where you want to start. The one of the problems of doing factorial trials is there's almost too much information to try and digest. And I think in many ways, I am a victim of the way that we decided to publish the data, which was, you know, very much consistent with good clinical trial reporting, in that the most interesting effects were probably not what we thought they were going to be when we started. And so after that, it became very hard to try and get to the truth of what I think the results ended up showing, particularly for plasma exchange, where the sort of immediate take-home message was Pexavast killed plasma exchange. And unfortunately, you know, trials are just not that easy sometimes to try and understand. So what would you like to do, Mike? Do you want to start with plasma exchange? Do you want to talk about the reconciliation of FESG real-world data and reduced-dose glucocorticoids?
Yeah, let's save FESG to the end, because I feel like I'm on the shakiest footing there. And let me just stick my neck out and let you take a bite out of my perspective here. And so for framing first, very happy that you're here as a nephrologist. We love nephrologists and rheumatology. So no disclaimer necessary there. I don't mind you putting Matt's PhD on shaky footing. That's okay. I would also say that I'm very grateful that you're doing this. I love your work. I've enjoyed your publications. And I would also say that I love Pexavas. It's my favorite RCT. I was on the Blue Ribbon panel for the Rheum Madness crew a couple years back, and I voted Pexavas all the way to the finale, but other people outvoted me, and so it wasn't chosen as the greatest trial of the year, but I thought that it was. So, you know, I'm a Pexavas diehard, and I would also say that I believe Pexavas. I think there is no benefit for the vast majority of patients with ANCA vasculitis for either plasma exchange or a standard steroid taper. So I feel like we actually agree on a lot of things, but here I'm going to stick my neck out. Yeah, the pivotal.
We don't quite agree as much as you think.
Yeah, okay, cool. Well, I'm excited to hear you tear apart into those as well. The thing that I suspect we're going to disagree about, and but feel free to find other areas, was my main concern with Pexavas is generalizability, as with a lot of trials. And, you know, I think something like 9% of patients in the trial had severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. And so I wonder how much it applies to that specific group of people. Only about 20% were undergoing dialysis. Only about less than a third had severe creatinine issues at baseline. And so before I saw anything else, I was already kind of wondering whether the kind of headline results generalized to these subsets of people who are severely ill. And then, you know, I think there's a couple data points we want to talk about, one being the FVSG data. But then the other thing I want to talk about is this subset analysis of patients with diffuse alveolar hemorrhage that was published by you and Dr. Fussner as the lead author recently, which kind of looked at this subset of people with severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. And when that was initially presented at ACR 2 years ago, there was a Kaplan-Meier curve that really, really looked like patients with severe DH had some benefit from getting plasma exchange. And I remain concerned that that might be true. And so I'd like to hear your thoughts on that first. I mean, am I totally off the out of left field here? Or what do you think?
So I like to think of these all as stories. Okay. How does the trial story unfold? So we went from a position where we were practicing treating people with DH with nothing than some case series and some anecdotes. And those case series suggested, one, that when things were not great for the ventilated DAH patients, they would almost always die, and that then with the introduction of plasma exchange, maybe they would live to at least get off the ventilator and short-term outcomes looked better. Some of the less publicized data also, though, showed that in places where plasma exchange was not routinely available, those patients also started doing better as time went on. In fact, that the biggest threat to their well-being was infection, not death by alveolar hemorrhage, but rather death by infection. So when we were designing Pexivas, we went, well, we think this is a big problem, that there's this group of patients that we are really, really worried about, but we're just treating them with essentially a whiff of data and a lot of intuition. And we really missed out on opportunities to be able to understand what the best possible treatments are. So we started off with even if we only randomized two people in the end, we might be a little bit better off than had we never included them, because at least we open up the door for future studies to be able to try and figure out what the right path is for these folks. We did a lot better than that, though. And in fact, you say we only had 100 patients with cerebellar hemorrhage, but in fact, that's an infinite times number more than were randomized in previous studies. We were fortunate that some of our colleagues or specs had told us that, you know, you should really try and do some rough categorization of how serious the hemorrhage is. And so we did that, and we were able to really help understand that non-severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage doesn't seem to impact mortality at all, which was a nice outcome from Dr. Fussner's paper, and that severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, which is hypoxic at less than 85%, actually still has a very strong effect on mortality, a five-fold increased risk of mortality over otherwise similar patients. It also shows, though, that although the point estimates for death in those who are treated with plasma exchange look a bit better, it's really imprecise. As you said, it still is a small number. Math doesn't care whether or not we are treating rare diseases. It cares how many patients and how many outcomes we're able to tally, and so it's imprecise. So I think the real breakthrough within Lynn's paper was that we were able to look at more sensitive measures of effect, and in this case, ventilation time, or we weren't able to see any difference in ventilation. The other thing is that when we look at mortality, you know, we don't just look at the point estimate for the group with diffuse alveolar hemorrhage or no diffuse alveolar or non-severe alveolar hemorrhage. We look at whether or not it looks like there is a difference between those groups that's out of the play of chance. And there was concordance there with the fact that we saw no evidence of effect in the ventilation times. But I'd also put forward that one of the funny things that is difficult to appreciate is that you see the same point estimate for non-severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. But non-severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage isn't associated with death. So how do you benefit a group that doesn't have a risk factor for death with that intervention? If it's good for alveolar hemorrhage and reducing the mortality from alveolar hemorrhage, how does that benefit people who don't have a risk of death from alveolar hemorrhage?
Yeah, so I'll have to, so let me just respond to a couple things first. And that last point, I'd like to have you flesh out a little more. So first, you know, just to give some numbers from that Fussner paper that we're referencing. So among people with diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, you know, the rate of mortality from diffuse alveolar hemorrhage was much elevated. So if you look at the severe group, those ones who did not get plasma exchange had an 8.4% chance of dying in 1 year. Those who did get plasma exchange had a 15.6% chance of dying in 1 year. So those numbers are clearly numerically different. If you look at the Kaplan-Meier curve, those curves were clearly quite a bit different. But what you're pointing out is that, you know, the hazard ratios clearly included one. There was no clear sign. You know, this wasn't significantly different by any stretch of imagination. And a similar story can be told about the glucocorticoid. And so, you know, from a purist p-value perspective, and just from a statistical perspective, there's no, you know, there's no statistically significant difference between those two groups. Now, when I look at it, I just wonder if there's quite enough people there. I say, man, I feel like if we kept enrolling these severe people, we might have seen that become statistically significant. We could cycle back to that again when we talk about the end-stage kidney disease, because I also liked your meta-analysis where you had a similar perspective and saw that. But to the question of ventilator-free days, I heard you made this point on Twitter, and I don't know how to assess ventilator-free days in this context. You know, so for people who aren't familiar with ventilator-free days, the idea is that we're trying to get a sense of not just mortality, but also other things that matter, like being stuck on a ventilator. So we say, you know, 28 days out, how many of the 28 days were you on the vent? And so you subtract that from 28 or something. So say you spent 10 days on the ventilator, you had 18 ventilator-free days. If you died before 28 days, you get zero. If you stay on the vent for 28 days, you also get zero. So I think that's a good outcome measure. I don't object to it. Obviously, days on the vent are worse than days off the vent. It's a patient-centric outcome measure. But I wanted to give you a couple critiques of this particular outcome and see if you have a response to that. And so there's three critiques that I have. The first is that vent-free days doesn't really discriminate between component risks. So, you know, someone who had 28 days who was ventilated and someone who died, those are treated the same and they're not quite the same. I don't think there's that many people that would be in either of those in the 28-day ventilated group, but that's still, those are different things, right? And then the second is that, you know, this doesn't account for how well you did once you got off the ventilator. So, you know, two patients who both were on the ventilator for 6 days, one of them could go on to do very poorly and one of them could go on to do very well. So it's not the only thing that matters. And then neither one really accounts for subsequent reintubation. And we've seen this in other critical care studies where patients who may have been liberated early because of some sort of intervention later went on to do poorly. Perhaps patients who got plasma exchange were more likely to have an early infection or something like that, and then less likely later on to succumb from lung-related damage. I mean, there's certainly some ways I could imagine ventilator-free days not being a perfect outcome measure. So I'd like to hear your response to that, and then I want to hear your thoughts on the point estimate after.
Well, I'd suggest there's no such thing as a perfect outcome. You know, they're all fallible. And what we look for is not a perfect outcome. We look for concordance and consistency so that the story that we get from all of the different data points that we've collected actually makes sense to us. And so what I would put forward is, in fact, that, you know, if you don't see a strong effect on death overall from plasma exchange in a group who are at high risk of dying from ANCA-associated vasculitis, and you don't see a strong effect or any effect in the ventilator-free time, and you see something that doesn't make sense in terms of the way that another subgroup with a similar but less severe manifestation goes, and then you don't get the appropriate test of interaction to support the observed difference in the point estimates, then I would say that that creates a pattern for me of coherence. I'm okay with accepting. Could we be missing it? Could we be missing an effect? Absolutely, sure. You can say that about every study that does not exclude the null. You can always have an issue with power. And so could we be missing a significant effect? Sure. We could be missing a really clinically important effect. But we're also pretty confident the plasma exchange was causing infections. And so would I take the risk of subjecting someone to plasma exchange on the off chance that we missed a benefit, but give them the risk of infection? Probably not, unless there is a situation in which I would go, there's no longer anything to be missed. This person is so likely to die that my ability to add to the risk of death approaches zero. In which case, then we would go, this is the last ditch effort. When we talked to our critical care colleagues, though, they said they don't know who that individual is. So far be it from me to say as a nephrologist that I know which DAH patient is going to die regardless of what we do now. So that makes it very hard to ever justify using plasma exchange for alveolar hemorrhage alone.
Yeah, I think that especially for people who aren't on the ventilator or who have an oxygen saturation at normal, I wouldn't give them plasma exchange because of the math that you discuss. I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the pathophysiology about this. This isn't a debate topic. I'm just genuinely curious. Do you think the infection comes from just putting in a dialysis line because that's obviously associated with the risk of infection? Or do you think that, you know, we're cleaning out the malhumors and we're also cleaning out useful immunoglobulins? Or do you think there's some third reason that people were getting more infections? Because the finding of an increased infection risk associated with plasma exchange, I think is a really important one. So what drove that?
I wish I knew. I don't think it's just central venous catheters. So in fact, there's a reasonable number of patients treated entirely by peripheral within the trial. And, you know, there's a lot of other patients who had central venous catheters and have the same infectious risk necessarily because it's a lot of risk. So I don't know. I wish I did. I think this is one of the exciting areas for the next few years where we have some more planned. And it is one of the really, I think, cool things about plasma exchange is that we go from a proteome that reflects a diseased patient or, you know, a whole biomarker set that goes beyond the proteome to a proteome that has been substantially reduced in 2 weeks by plasma exchange to then a reconstituted proteome under the effects of immunosuppression in the weeks after that. And we're fortunate that we have So almost half the patients have blood work done at these 3 points where we're now trying to work through these analyses to try and understand these mechanisms. You know, some of it might just be that these are folks who had an innate risk of infection, and we've just exacerbated it by further removal of protein X that predisposes them to infection. I don't know. I really don't. And, you know, why didn't we see it before? Well, actually, it was always there. It's completely consistent with previous plasma exchange and ANCA-associated vasculitis trials. You don't see it in the plasma exchange trials for neurologic diseases and things, but they have such a low risk of infection that the chances of ever detecting it is tiny. You know, like you'd have to be really lucky to ever be able to find it, or really unlucky because they would have to have a much higher baseline risk of infection. Our patients have a really big risk of infection to begin with, and it still took, you know, 1,000 patients essentially to be able to find the infection risk.
Yeah, this infection susceptibility in people with ANCA vasculitis seems to be one of the uniquely bad infection susceptibilities among our diseases. I'm moderately obsessed with PJP prophylaxis, and patients with ANCA vasculitis far and away have the highest risk of that, of any of the diseases, at least rheumatologists. I imagine transplant nephrologists would say something. But so actually, I kind of want to touch base on that briefly. So I also enjoyed your meta-analysis where you sort of expanded or you included the PEXAVAS data with some of the other smaller trials of plasma exchange. And in that study, you kind of established there's an increased risk of infection. And you said that there is maybe a reduced risk of end-stage renal disease associated with plasma exchange, which to my knowledge, you didn't really see that in the PEXAVAS trial itself. So just, I don't mean this as a gotcha question, but why wouldn't we see the same thing if we had a big enough sample with the diffuse alveolar hemorrhage group? Sort of just discuss that for me.
So maybe you would. I don't know. You might not see it. You might see it. You might see something going in the opposite direction. I think, you know, Using the term a p-value that's trending is dirty to me. It suggests that you know what the truth is and you're just waiting for the data to catch up to it. And the honest answer is we don't know. It could be anywhere from protective, strongly protective, to strongly harmful. And I have no idea. But, you know, I could say the same thing about a whole bunch of other interventions. For all I know, taking 10 watermelons a day is protective or harmful. I don't know. You can come up with some, you know, completely backwards rationale around why that may or may not work too. The thing around plasma exchange is someone thought it worked. We applied it. It seemed to fit with some notions about why it would work. And then we assume that the data is going to catch up to our understanding and our pre-existing belief and the 50 years of training that we've subjected people to saying that this is for this disease. I think the honest answer with plasma exchange so far is that the data does not catch up to most places where we thought it was going to work. And these kind of simple assumptions that autoantibody-related disease will respond to a device that takes them out has not been true. And so we really need to stress those assumptions empirically.
All right, then let me ask you a question that I asked you on Twitter. And sorry, Matt, you can dive in and talk if you want, but I'm having fun here. So I asked you on this on Twitter, and I loved your answer. It was surprising to me, although I think consistent with the study and with the guidelines. So you said on Twitter, I said, you know, how many different types of steroid tapers do you have for ANCA vasculitis? And you said you have one, and I love that because that's very definitive. I have three. I use a version of the low-VAS taper for patients with not severe. And in cases where I'm using avacopan, I still give those people a steroid. I use the PEX-VAS standard for people who are severe, but not super sick. You know, people who aren't on the vent and aren't having rapidly progressive renal disease. And if people are having rapidly progressive renal disease and severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage on the vent, I will use a more of a PEX-VAS standard style taper. So you said that you don't do that at all, and I'd like you to disabuse me of this practice. Why is that an irrational approach to sort of approach this from a stratified perspective?
Well, let me ask you, what is your goal? Why do you want to give more steroids to the patient that is sicker?
Yeah, that's a great question. So, you know, I think that steroids are one of the worst things that we do to people. I very much dislike steroids. And so if I have a patient who's relatively healthy, I think the low VAS data was convincing for sort of a healthy MPO-ish group of patients. And I think that the PEX-VAS data kind of pushed you towards it. You know, an advocate looked pretty good. So I think that a lot of people can get away with very little steroids. And so if I can get away with little steroids, I will. I think the best supported regimen, because as everyone knows, there's a increased risk of infection among patients who got the standard dose regimen in PEX. So I think that the low dose regimen in PEX-VAS has good data for the vast majority of people with ANCA vasculitis. I think a lot of people can probably get less than that. But then you kind of alluded to this earlier when you said this super, super sick group of people where, you know, I think the people who are intubated with the severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage or who have very severe kidney disease, I worry that those patients need a little bit extra. And this gets back to my fundamental concern about generalizability, where I don't have a firm degree of confidence that the low dose data, the low dose regimen from PEX-VAS generalizes to this sickest of the sick group. And so that's that. I would say that this is a very small sliver of patients. 90, 95% of my patients are getting PEX-VAS low or less. But there's some people in there that I would. So that's my rationale for it.
I think this is a pretty common stance where people go, these folks are really sick. I'm really worried about them. I need to give them more therapy. And you go, okay, well, on the whatever this current standard of care is, the not more therapy, what are you worried about them dying from? Because that's what we're trying to prevent for the most part, right? You're trying to prevent organ failure and dying. And so you go, okay, well, I don't want them to die. Okay, what are they dying from? By far and away, the most common cause of death is infection. You're like, okay, so what I need to do is I need to minimize the chances of them having an infection while I maximize disease. Can I tell who in advance amongst those people who are really sick, who's going to get an infection? Because it's not 100%. It's probably somewhere in the order of a third to a half. Oh, no. In fact, there's no data to suggest that I can accurately predict amongst that sort of top quartile of ill individual who's going to get the infection and who isn't, and who is going to have resistant disease and who isn't. We're very bad at predicting or identifying individuals who are going to have an outcome that is different than the standard. Then 90%, you know, to people respond quite well to a standard regimen. So if I can't tell which individual that is, then the probability I'm putting a lot of faith in my expert eye and going like, oh, I'm not going to screw this one up. I'm not going to subject them to the 25% increased risk or the 40% risk of infection with the standard dose steroids. And they're definitely going to be the ones who get the benefit. I would say that's incorrect. If I can't tell, I should start everyone at the same point, and then I can react to things as they unfold. And that is one of the true beauties of steroids that I think we fail to appreciate, is this is a titratable drug. You go like, oh man, I don't think things are going that well. I got to go up. Or like, oh man, they're falling apart right now. I got to go down fast. We actually have that ability. That was one of the, what I was always in the back of my mind in Pexivas, was that if we saw people react very strongly, they like, oh, I think something is really well or really bad, they were going to fall off the rails by taper. That didn't happen. We had almost none of that. We were so shocked by our own results. Every time reviewed data on adherence, we were like, whew. People are really good liars, or we're doing really well. I think we actually just did really well. We really just had very little non-adherence outside of sort of the time frame of people, missing their taper by a couple of, by a week or something because they missed their appointments. But that's it. And so we didn't see that happen empirically. You just don't see that there's a bunch of patients that you really have to deviate from the reduced dose taper.
Yeah, and specifically when you say non-adherence, you're referring to people having to escalate steroids. You mean that people on the most people who were on the low dose taper wound up being just fine on the low dose
Yeah,
taper.
they just stayed on the low dose taper.
Yeah, my contention would be 90%, 91% of those people had non-severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. But I see what you're saying, and I agree. And I think to put
But Mike,
it
this isn't
like,
an issue of generalizability. This is an issue of effect modification. So, we don't see any difference with those who have severe disease. There was nothing in our data that ever suggested that people with more severe disease were going to have a different beneficial outcome from low versus standard dose steroids. But the risk of infection applied to everyone. And in fact, all of those sicker patients have a higher baseline risk of infection. So the absolute harms that you do are actually magnified in those individuals.
Yeah, and I think that what you're suggesting that the absolute harms are probably magnifying. I suspect that the benefits would be magnified if they exist. And
Yeah, I'm
so
more
I think
confident
that.
that one exists than the other. So again, it's like plasma exchange and
Yeah.
DAH. Are you willing to bet that you're the one who got it right? I know lots of individuals who are. I know some people who think that Pexivas reduce means give them 100 twice a day of prednisone
100 twice a day.
because they feel like, oh no, this is much more reduced than I was going to give them. But it's entirely based on the I know this disease so well that I'm going to be able to pick out the right individuals. And I personally do not feel like I can do that.
I
I
also
do
don't
see a
think
fair bound.
I also don't think that I'm capable of doing that. I think you just put it very well, where you said that the harms are magnified in these sickest of the sick people. I very much believe that. I think that that's very fair. I also believe that there's probably no substantial benefit to plasma exchange or high dose steroids for people who aren't on the vent and don't have rapidly progressive renal disease. But I think that there may be some benefit if it's there. That's where it would be. And I think the mortality of these patients is quite high, and especially when people are really sick, I feel like I give it a try. But I can see your point's well taken. Can we translate? Unless you have anything else you want to say, I want to transition to the French vascular study group study. I just want to hear your thoughts in general.
Let me just say one last thing about plasma exchange, because I think we kind of danced around it, is in the meta-analysis, moderate certainty that there is a significant reduction in end-stage kidney disease at 1 year and an attenuated benefit as we go out to a view and follow-up. We really debated hard about what that really means. And this actually came right back to the whole baseline risk issue, that for someone who's at really high risk of kidney failure, getting a 30 to 40% relative risk reduction to kidney disease for 1 year is actually probably a really big benefit of them. End-stage kidney disease is bad. That's just it's a bad state. And you can also see this, that there was a ton of variation in how much people valued avoiding end-stage kidney disease versus potential risk of harm and being relatively neutral on mortality. And I still find like there's a, it's like turning into a second religion of people who believe in the end-stage kidney disease results and people who don't. I think nephrologists tend to gravitate towards like this is a whole focus of our being is to try and to reduce dialysis dependency, so we want to believe. And it has been a difficult one to reconcile.
I think that's well put, and that's a great example of like how I'm framing the lung stuff as well. Like I believe your results from that meta-analysis that among, you know, there's maybe a benefit for end-stage kidney disease, and I reserve that for people who are quite sick. I just think there's probably that for
Yeah, but we found some evidence for it in end-stage kidney disease. We didn't find the evidence for it in mortality and in DAH.
I think that had there been, 30% of people with severe DH and pexivas, and had there been, throw MAPEX and some other studies in there which had an equivalent amount of severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, had it not shown what we saw in end-stage kidney disease, I would be on board. I think
Well,
that we just don't
let me
have
ask
the
you this, Mike.
data.
Let me ask you this. Pretend that no one was using plasma exchange for AAV before Apexivax. Would you start using it for DAH on the basis of those results?
I would start using it for DH on the basis of your meta-analysis for end-stage kidney disease because,
Yeah, but that's not the question I'm asking. I'm saying for DAH, you start exchanging people with DAH.
Without absent the data in end-stage kid, in, I mean that's kind of a strange question. I mean I think independently. Sorry.
No one's using plasma exchange. We publish Pexivas, you see the results, you see the meta-analysis, you see that there is no effect on mortality. You have a patient in the ICU in front of you with DAH who has a creatinine of one.
Yeah. We're
Do you
creating
exchange them?
a oof. If they're okay, so you're saying we haven't been doing this for years for diffuse alveolar hemorrhage, but we have Pexavast, we have MAPEX, we have your meta-analysis. We have a good sense that it increases the risk of infection may decrease the risk of end-stage kidney disease a little bit. Would I use it for someone with severe intubated diffuse alveolar hemorrhage in the absence of bad kidney disease? The answer is I would have a discussion with the patient's family and I would offer that. Yeah, I would. And the reason being that I think that there's probably some shared pathophysiology where you have autoimmunity driving organ inflammation and organ damage that causes end-stage kidney disease. And I think a similar aberrant immune pathology is driving the inflammation in the lungs that drives severe diffuse alveolar hemorrhage. And so it makes sense to me that an intervention that would improve the end-stage kidney disease from ANCA vasculitis among patients who are very sick would also improve the risk of dying from lung disease among patients who are very sick.
That's a great answer. That's the issue that keeps me up at night,
Okay.
is how is it good for one organ and not good for the other if we think that it's a...
And this is why I sleep so well because I think it works for both. Just kidding.
Wait, you just told me it doesn't work for kidneys.
No, I'm on board for kidneys. No, I'm on board for kidneys.
Oh, okay.
I believe your meta-analysis. I'm in the group that thinks that it helps with the kidneys some. Yeah. I don't use it for everybody. I mean, if someone comes with a creatinine of 2.1, I'm not gonna plasma exchange them. But people who come in and are requiring dialysis in the hospital, I offer them plasma exchange because I think that the potential benefit for saving their kidneys outweighs the known increased risk of infection from plasma exchange. All right. So last before we leave,
I
I want
just
to hear
wanted to
your
jump in actually to say that I think that this taps onto one other really important issue that doesn't affect Walsh quite as much. But Putman, the other thing that comes out of all of this is we have all of this data. What are we going to do for EGPA, which is probably the form of vasculitis which has the greatest amount of steroid morbidity because we've had so much trouble treating them and their airway disease over time. And I haven't got any answers to this yet, but I think that how we think about these data in terms of that, which we some people think has components of the vasculitis that similar pathophysiology but not the same, is a really important question and sort of like the next frontier for how we deal with this because it is a different disease, but it is also similar.
EGPA is a different entirely. I think we should be using more cyclophosphamide PA. So, Dr. Walsh, I want to hear your thoughts on the FVSG study. For background, this is an observational data study. It was presented at ACR as a plenary session by Sophie Nagel. This is the French Vasculitis Study Group. And they looked at observational data. They looked at patients who got more of a standard dose Pexavast style taper or a low dose Pexavast style taper. They had a lot more patients who got rituximab in their study. And what they saw was that the reduced dose glucocorticoid regimen was associated with an increased risk of their primary outcome, which was, I believe, survival, event-free survival. So, Dr. Walsh, what are your thoughts on that study in particular? And if you'd rather just make a meta point about observational data and how it relates to RCTs, that's also great.
I think you know, it's an intriguing look at something that's actually really difficult to do, because classifying real world steroid use into two regimens sounds like the devil's work to me. You know, trying to classify anyone outside our own hospital seems pretty darn hard. So that's really interesting. I think, you know, if Pexivas hadn't existed and this was the first look at two different steroid regimens in ANCA-associated vasculitis, you'd go, oh man, that's intriguing. We should really do a randomized trial. Well, the thing is, we did the randomized trial, and so we did a larger randomized trial that included substantially more outcomes and precision, and was substantially less at risk of bias and random error. And we came up with almost exactly the opposite set of answers. And so I would suggest that, you know, in general, I would go, that's still very interesting, and we should seek to understand why they got such disparate answers compared to Pexivas, but I wouldn't let it change my practice. The follow-up question is probably, but what about the rituximab? They had, I think, 160 odd patients on Rituxan, maybe 165, somewhere in there. And we had about 104, 100 like that in Pexivas. And you go like, oh, the Pexivas subgroup looks like it might have been a little bit different. But again, I'll point you to the counterfactual. So if you go like, oh, okay, rituximab looks a little bit different, and maybe rituximab is like, you know, a lighter version of cyclophosphamide. Well, if you take a look at the point estimates, the ordinals on those point estimates, it goes greatest benefit seen in IV cyclophosphamide, which is also able to be removed with plasma exchange, interestingly. Then you see oral cyclophosphamide in the middle, and then rituximab off on the less likely to do harm. So I don't think it's as simple as a like the depth of immunosuppression we gave them was might be considered lesser with rituximab. In fact, there's really little to suggest that rituximab is inferior to cyclophosphamide. And so to me, it just doesn't quite make sense. You know, it's one of those ones where, again, I think we can paint ourselves a rationale to try and fit the data, but I don't know if that's really true. The other thing I would say is that, you know, rituximab and Pexivas was a really funny time in the history of ANCA-associated vasculitis, because it just kind of come out as acceptable induction treatment, but we had no idea what to do with maintenance. And so most of those patients actually were maintenance free in the first year. So if the FESG data, which uses you know, a composite of relapses, progressive disease, ESKD and death, and a lot of it is driven by progressive disease and relapses, well, it's a little bit different perhaps now than it was back then. I don't even think I would believe the direction of the point estimate for ours. Maybe we're undertreating them, but I don't think so. Again, that confidence interval is gigantic because it's such an imprecise estimate. And even then, it's based on, you know, the comparison of a lot of events between categories for suppression.
All right, I think that's pretty fair. I'm excited to see their final publication and see what they show. And I suspect there will be some good observational data in the future to flesh this out. Most excited about something on the diffuse alveolar hemorrhage group or diffuse alveolar hemorrhage question, but it's going to get harder and harder to do that too, because the further we get out, the more confounded these steroid tapers are going to be. So I don't know. It's going to be an interesting area of discussion for the foreseeable future.
Yeah,
I don't, yeah.
I was just going to say, from that paper, I'm most interested to see how they actually got to the categorization of steroid regimens, because, you know, like, it's really hard. And if you're doing it after the fact, then oftentimes you're doing it on what people were reacting to, particularly in progressive disease, where people decided they didn't want to initiate the rapid taper because they think that the kidneys are not quite responding yet. And progressive disease, again, that's devil's work too. It's like, what actually constitutes progressive disease in a renal population? Very difficult.
Yeah, and I would almost argue there's probably like a different pathophysiology about of those folks. And so it's almost like a different group entirely. All
Yeah,
right.
mine
Well,
was a
I think
lot
this
more
has been a lot of
classification.
yeah, this is a lot of fun. Dr. Walsh, do you want any, the last word? Anything you want to add before we close?
No, just that I'm embarrassed that you sleep well at night because of your firm belief in shared pathophysiology and treatment effects, and I still can't get a rest.
That's a great place to end. Matt, you want to take us away?
No, yes, but thank you guys. Thank you both so much for being here and having us on, Dr. Putman. It was great to do this, and I think we have probably we've probably answered as many questions as many more questions we have asked. So I don't think that this could probably be a running series where every 2 years we check back in on the state of conflicting randomized and observational data and vasculitis. So hopefully this means that in a little bit longer, we'll be able to have this chat again about the next hot trials off the presses and be a little bit less confused, but I'm not particularly optimistic about that one.
Great. Well, I'll see you both in March 6th of 2026. Thanks so much to everyone for listening. Thanks to all of y'all for doing this, and have a great day, everybody.